This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. We come to you from Baker's Bar and Lounge in Hamtramck, Michigan, on the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. Going to talk about some conversations with workers about, well, decent wages, decent hours, decent conditions. Our friends at One Fair Wage have put together an incredible event here at Baker's Bar and Lounge. We're going to talk to some work people to find out what here in Michigan they're doing to ensure that, well, there's one wage, one fair wage. We do away with this tipped sub-minimum wage nonsense. We pay people a decent living wage, and we move work forward. And this is one of those things that we've been talking about here on the program for quite some time. How do you make people's lives better? How do you make better lives for working people? How do you do that? Well, you do that by people coming together. And that's exactly what the folks here in Hamtramck are doing today as we spend the next couple of hours talking about the trials, the tribulations, how difficult it is to get by on a sub-minimum wage. And on minimum wage as a whole, understand, if minimum wage had kept up with productivity, minimum wage would be like 20, 23, 24 bucks an hour. Had it kept up with CEO pay, well, let's not even begin to talk about how insane that would be. Because what's happened in this country is we have not shared in the wealth that our labor has created. And we see this time and time again as we've gone on this tour. And it was never really, to this point, never more stark than what we saw in Scranton. The children in mines, you know, crawling around in muck and filth and desperation to create massive amounts of wealth for the handfuls, while communities suffered, struggled, and, well, starved. The reality is we are seeing inequality grow at rates never seen before in our lifetime. And this is a moment. This is a moment for us. It's a moment for us to step forward, stand up, speak out, and say, you know what, maybe we can do better. Now, look, I'm thrilled to see what's coming out of the White House. I'm thrilled to see the kind of organizing that's going on in the streets. And this goes hand in hand. Look, we've got an administration right now that's listening to working people. We've got an administration right now that's concerned about working people. That hasn't happened in a very long time, which is why you're seeing all of the moneyed interests throwing into these outlandish attacks against the administration. Right now, there's an opportunity. There is an opportunity to move in a direction to rebuild, revitalize, re-energize a prosperous working class, to make work pay again, to create wealth in the hands of the working people who spend the money. This is the mastery of what my grandparents' generation built. A generation of working people who had wealth, disposable income that they could then go into the economy and spend, and entrepreneurs, you know, made products and services that people wanted, and it was this snowball forward. We haven't seen that in a while. What we've done is we've built, sadly, what is the wealthiest economy in the world on the backs of, well, desperate labor, easy credit, and exploitable markets. And I was watching this clip the other day of Warren Buffett saying, look, you know, we won. We're winning. My class is winning. Enormously winning. You know, we've seen our wealth go from some $90 billion of the Fortune 400 in 1982, you know, $2.5 trillion. You've seen this explosion of accumulation of wealth at the very, at the, just the very tippity top. And we've talked about this, how, you know, the bottom half of the country has seen actually a negative gain in wealth, while the top 1% is just off the charts. And for me, it starts with this kind of grassroots organizing. It starts with people coming together. It starts with people speaking out and saying, you know what, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We're no longer going to take it. And we're seeing it. I mean, you know, I was just reading another story. There's organizing at Home Depot. There's organizing at REI. There's organizing in so many different places. Amazon, Starbucks, you name it. There are people who are finally saying, you know what? We want better. We want more. We want opportunity. We want a chance for the future. So today on the program, that's what we're going to be spending a little time talking about here at Baker's Bar and Lounge in Hamtramck, Michigan, here on the Working Class Radio Tour. We want to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And I want to throw a shout out and a thanks to our friends at American Family Voices, also Courier Newsroom, for throwing us some support and helping us get out on the road and talking to people and sharing stories and, well, you know, coming up with how do we move forward? How do we do what we want to do? Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the best of The Rick Smith Show. We're taking a break during the holiday season, wishing you and yours the very best holiday ever. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. At 2:02 in the afternoon, President Woodrow Wilson at the White House touched off an explosion at the Gamboa Dike in Panama. With that touch of a button, the last barrier to joining the waters of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans through the Panama Canal went up in smoke. The Chicago Tribune described the scene in Panama, writing, quote, "Then suddenly came the muffled roar of the discharge of 1,600 pounds of dynamite, which sent a shower of water, mud, and rock high into the air. Spreading out as it went upward, the hole heavily veiled into a cloud of smoke. As water began to pour through the rent made by the explosion, the crowd sent up a great cheer. It was a noteworthy moment in the construction of the canal, but that moment came at a staggering cost of workers' lives. For more than 20 years, the French and then the United States worked on the canal project. The U.S. phase lasted for a decade. As many as 45,000 workers toiled on the canal during the peak years of construction. These workers came from the United States, Europe, Asia, and Panama. West Indians formed the core of the work crews. These workers faced stifling heat, brutal working conditions, and poor accommodations. Workers had to contend with ravaging disease, poisonous snakes, and torrential rains. Workers also faced racial discrimination. For example, West Indian workers earned half the hourly wages of U.S. and European workers. They also lived in much more crowded barracks. Worker deaths were so frequent that death or funerary trains made continual runs to bring the bodies away from the construction site. It is estimated that more than 27,000 men died building the canal. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1874. That was the day that Mary Heaton Vorse was born in New York City. Mary grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, in a family with significant financial means. She traveled across Europe with her parents, where she received her education and learned to speak multiple languages fluently. She then worked as a book reviewer for the Criterion magazine. In 1912, Mary and the man who would be her husband witnessed what would be known as the Bread and Roses textile strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The experience was a great turning point in her life. She later wrote, "Both Joe O'Brien and I had come a long road to get to Lawrence. Together, we experienced the realization of the human cost of our industrial life. Something transforming happened to both of us. We knew now where we belonged. On the side of the workers and not with the comfortable people among whom we were born. Some synthesis had taken place between my life and that of the workers. Some peculiar change that would never again permit me to look with indifference on the fact that riches for the few were made by misery of the many. It was in Lawrence that we realized what we must do, that we could make one contribution, that of writing the workers' story as long as we lived." For more than 50 years after Lawrence, Mary traveled the United States reporting and participating in strikes and the labor movement. She wrote about the 1919 steel strike and the lumber workers' strike in the Pacific Northwest. She wrote about the struggles of auto workers and textile workers and child labor. In 1962, the United Auto Workers honored Mary with their Social Justice Award. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
This is the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Baker's Bar here in Hamtramck, Michigan, as we continue our Working Class Heroes radio tour. Today we're talking with low-wage workers about, fighting for dignity, fighting for respect, One Fair Wage. Our friends at One Fair Wage put together a great event of low-wage workers coming out here to the bar, spend a little time of community, a little time coming together, but also talking about a very important issue, and that is dignity, respect, and all of that on the job, making a living wage and making jobs that are available, good family-sustaining wage jobs. And I'm sitting here with my executive producer and Working Class Hero Radio Tour co-host, Brett Pransky, the professor. Brett, how are we doing today?
We're doing great. Having a great time here.
So what do you think of this bar? I mean, I got to tell you, I love these old-time bars. Reminds me of being a kid again.
Yeah, I mean it's a great old place. It looks like we should be shooting a movie here. You know what I mean? It looks like a perfect old time movie scene.
Yeah, I mean, and getting here was interesting as well, because you hear about these towns and you hear all of these rumors, you hear all this stuff, and what a beautiful little place. I mean, I wish we had more time to spend, going through all of the shops and all of the bakery down the block.
Yeah, I mean, I really wish we could. I mean, just with what's going on and how many different places we go and how quickly we have to get there, the downside of that is we don't get to spend the time that we would like to in some of these destinations, to explore, to really get to know the neighborhood. It seems like, too quickly we have to pack up our gear and move on to the next destination.
And pack up the gear, that was a fun kind of bit. And look, we've been traveling several days now. We're traveling in this giant RV. So you kind of get this picture. We roll up in these inner city settings in this giant RV, and there's literally nowhere to park. We're down in the parking lot way at the, like a mile away. We've got to lug our gear down the road. But the interesting thing is you're bumping into people in this area, Hamtramck, very diverse. In fact, we were talking to one of the people in the bar who had grown up here and has spent his entire life here. He said, look, this used to be, the kind of place you didn't walk around with a bunch of expensive gear. And now it's a thriving area. It's coming back. He was saying when he was younger, the rent here was like $200 a month. It was, mm-hmm. He used the S-hole word. And, now, it's a very diverse community. The storefronts are full. There are people coming back. There's activity. And again, I come back to, it's the movement that we're coming back to. It's the investments in communities like this that I think are helping.
Yeah, I really think that's the case. I mean, the gentleman that you're speaking of was born in Ukraine, came over as a very small child, spent his entire life here. and saw the neighborhood transition and saw, you know, different populations come and go, and saw some of the old storefronts go away and new storefronts coming in. And, you know, there's been some real improvements here over time.
Now, the interesting thing to me, and this is where we're kind of in this weird moment, we spent a little time talking to people, talking to some low-wage workers, that fear, and this is, you know, this is another one of those moments of the moment in time that we live in, the lack of power of workers and the lack of power that they feel. We couldn't get anyone to come on air and say, hey, this is what it is. But the stories we heard, you're heartbreaking.
Yeah, some of them really were. And, you know, there were people out there. Now, some were just kind of camera shy. You know, they had never done any media before and weren't really looking to get their start at it today. But there were people out there whose sole reason for not wanting to come on the air and tell their story was the fact they didn't think they should or didn't think they could, or that there was just simply too much to risk.
Now, again, I go back to, you know, one of the stories that we got, you know, this person was, you know, managing bars and restaurants before the pandemic. And again, the stories coming out of the pandemic is how poorly people are treating each other. And I guess that's going to be a theme as we travel across our tour, finding that, you know, maybe we're just not talking to each other well anymore.
Yeah, honestly, I think that is going to be a theme. I think it's something that we're going to see from place to place as we travel around. I mean, keep in mind, there was a very short time ago, these were the essential workers. That was a term that we heard, you know, in every broadcast everywhere, was these are essential workers, and without them, none of us would get by. And, you know, that everything was going to go to pieces if it wasn't for these essential workers doing heroic things to keep us going. And now that things are in the, you know, it's not that the pandemic's over, but things have calmed down. We found ways to, you know, to live with the conditions and so on. And we've gone right back to kind of the same levels, if not greater levels, of disrespect, you know, for these folks that we showed before the pandemic. And that's just, you know, that's just sad.
Now again, you know, you come back, as you said, you know, coming out of this pandemic, there's kind of an awakening, that moment of saying, you know, you are essential, you are patriotic frontline heroes. You kind of get a sense that these folks, you know, they bought it. They believed it. They wore that badge of honor, and they don't want to give it back.
Yeah, and also one thing that we saw, you know, especially coming out of the pandemic, was that, you know, this treatment, especially when things reverted back to how they were before, a lot of these folks just decided they weren't going to take it anymore. And they decided to move into different fields and, you know, and do different kinds of work. You know, and lots of times there were opportunities to do this because of, you know, some of the job creation, the massive job creation, you know, kind of as the pandemic has been winding down.
Now, I look at this and I keep coming back to the fact that our wage structure, the fact that workers have, especially at the lower end of the economy, such little power, such little ability to fight. And in fact, later on, we're going to talk with Representative Andy Levin about wage theft, because it's got to be one of the things that I bring up, because, you know, unions, you know, as someone who's been a union member my whole life, that's where I fight wage theft. If an employer were to cheat me, that's where I would go. Sadly, you know, most working people don't have that luxury. I'm hoping they get it. May want to make sure that happens. But what we know, and the studies are, you know, they're out there, that, you know, wage theft is one of the biggest crimes in this country. You know, you can add up all of the bank robberies, all the gas station stick-ups, all of the, hey, give me your money kind of robberies, and it would be like 10 times less of what wage theft is. And I know that's shocking, but you listen to some of the stories of the people that we've talked to, it's rampant.
Yeah, it really is. And a lot of it comes from, you know, some pretty basic understandings of the rules and the laws, and not necessarily the laws, but how they're enforced. There's a number of rules and laws out there that are supposed to rein in this type of behavior. But most of the time, what you'll find if you look into them is, even though a rule or a law or something may exist, the enforcement mechanism for it does not. So, you know, an employer may be able to, may do something, you know, improper, but the worker may not have the means to hold them accountable for it. So even when the law is there, we don't necessarily have a way to enforce it.
You know, I remember the first time I found out that wage theft existed. And I know, a little naive, it's when I met my wife. She was giving tours, you know, at the time I was volunteering as a big brother, and we went on the with Big Brothers Big Sisters, we went on this tour ride, And, you know, she was there and, you know, we were talking and we kind of hit it off and we were, you know, having a good time and, you know, all that. And at the end of the tour, they handed everyone envelopes and said, hey, if you enjoyed the tour, you know, give your tour guide a tip and, it's, all this stuff. And of course, being the male of the time, what do you think I did?
You probably left a pretty substantial tip, I'm guessing.
I did, equal to what the entire tour cost. And it wasn't until my wife and I were married about 10 years that I asked, I go, something? You remember that? And she's like, no, I never got it. And that's when she told me that the tips at that place were all collected by the company, held and pooled, they said, so that the full-time workers, not the volunteers like she was, they were given the luxury of a 1 week's vacation. You start doing the math of the hundreds, if not thousands, of people who go through there and people, dumb people like me, who leave, good sized tips, and how much those workers were being cheated because I put that money in that envelope, that tip in that envelope, specifically for the person that did the work that I was, trying to, eventually marry, but because they did a good job, and only to find out that it didn't get to them infuriated me.
Yeah, as it should. And when you think about it from her perspective, let's say that tip was stolen from her, which it obviously was, and she discovers that and she wants to do something about it. What exactly can she do? I mean, I'm sure she can quit and go work somewhere else, but that's not going to solve the problem. That's not going to alleviate the theft. So again, kind of like what I was saying earlier, the means of enforcement in many cases are not there. So even if you are wronged, and if you know you were wronged, and you want to do something about it, the means to do so in many cases just don't exist, or they're really hard to access.
And this is why it's so, again, you come back to, why do elections matter? This is why attorney generals matter. This is why having an attorney general who's going to fight for workers, like in our state, Josh Shapiro has done an incredible job, and here in Michigan, Dana Nessel, who we're going to have on the program tomorrow, has done a fantastic job on this front as well.
Yeah, they really have. I mean, again, I think if I remember right, I think Josh Shapiro took a case. It was the largest wage theft case in Pennsylvania's history. I believe it was just a few years ago while he was AG, and he was able to recover tens of millions of dollars for workers. I can't remember the name of the company that he took to court, but he was able to recover amounts in the tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, and again, I come back to this, and because it's an interesting juxtaposition. We had a president a couple of years ago who the person that he put in charge of protecting workers from wage theft was actually someone accused of wage theft. We now have an administration that is going after people, and actively going after people who cheat workers. So an interesting kind of juxtaposition, if you will.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, at the end of the day, and I say this everywhere you go, you get what you vote for. You know what I mean? When we vote for people who are going to rob us blind, we cannot be surprised when they turn around and rob us blind. And when we vote for people who say they're going to hold these folks accountable, then we get to expect them to do what they said they would do and hold these folks accountable. So really, at the end of the day, we get what we vote for. We get what we go to the polls and demand.
Yeah, I mean, but I go back to that moment and the anger, even today, and it's been 20 years, I'm still ticked off that she got cheated out of this. And now she understood what the game was, not that they were getting cheated, but that she wasn't entitled to that. So she wasn't upset. She was a volunteer. She just loved horses. It was all that. But what if that was her job? What if that's how she raised her children? She supported her family, supported herself, to have an employer be able to do that. And that's why I have some problems and some questions about, what we're doing with low-wage workers, especially the people who service our meals. On this tour, we've had some fabulous meals and some people who do wonderful work. I want to make sure that the tip that I give them actually gets into their pocket.
Yeah, and for example, you were talking about the case, with your wife when you first met. That company solicited a tip in her name, which is what really makes it terrible. They knew that she was never going to receive it, but they used her and her work to solicit a little extra money more than the cost of what they were charging people already. Yep. There's the real dishonesty in it.
The absolute dishonesty. Going to take a quick break back here from Baker's Bar in Hamtramck, Pennsylvania. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
The Rick.
Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Subtle results, still you, but with fewer lines. Botox Cosmetic, onabotulinum toxin A, is a prescription medicine used to temporarily make moderate to severe frown lines, crow's feet, and forehead lines look better in adults.
Effects of Botox Cosmetic may spread hours to weeks after injection, causing serious symptoms. Alert your doctor right away as difficulty swallowing, speaking, breathing, eye problems, or muscle weakness may be a sign of a life-threatening condition. Patients with these conditions before injection are at highest risk. Don't receive Botox Cosmetic if you have a skin infection. Side effects may include allergic reactions, injection site pain, headache, eyebrow and eyelid drooping, and eyelid swelling. Allergic reactions can include rash, welts, asthma symptoms, and dizziness. Tell your doctor about medical history, muscle or nerve conditions including ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, myasthenia gravis, or Lambert-Eaton syndrome and medications, including botulinum toxins, as these may increase the risk of serious side effects. For full safety information, visit BotoxCosmetic.com or call 877-351-0300.
See for yourself at BotoxCosmetic.com.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Baker's Bar and Lounge here in Hamtramck. I got to tell you, I love that name. It's a fun name to say, Hamtramck. It's such a fun name, such a fun city name to say. Welcome back here to our Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. We're in Hamtramck, Michigan. Yes, I am in Michigan. It's hard to believe that I have found my way here. As a kid growing up in Cleveland, still got that. It's kind of like finding me in Pittsburgh. It's one of those things. It's kind of weird. But I am here because I'm here for a good reason. We're going to fight for better wages, hours, conditions for working people, make lives better. This is what it's about. And I'm here talking with Roland Leggett. He is the Midwest campaign manager for the good folks at One Fair Wage, their website, onefairwage.org. Roland, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for coming. I didn't know you were from Cleveland, though. I would have had second thoughts about chatting with you. I'm just kidding. Welcome to Michigan, Rick.
It's an experience. But here's the thing, and this is the great part. You know, we were in Erie yesterday. I grew up in Cleveland. You know, I've been to places all across the country. It doesn't really matter where you're. It all looks kind of the same. You know, where working people are, it seems all kind of the same.
Yes, and
it has the same kind of flavor.
It has the same kind of flavor. We love good food, and we're hardworking. And I have to say, a lot of people that have I encourage people to explore the Midwest. It's one of the most beautiful parts of the country in certain places too.
So let's get into this. I mean, and thank you for inviting us here to this bar for this event to talk about something I think is really important and making sure that people earn a decent wage. I can't think of anything more that I'd rather talk about, because when we do that, we make lives better. And when we do that, we make communities better. And I think we make the country better, maybe pull us back together and end some of the partisanship that we see. And I understand Michigan is trying to do that by ending the sub-minimum wage. For folks who don't know what the sub-minimum wage is, you want to walk me through some of this?
Sure. So the sub-minimum wage is that wage that folks that are often in the food service industry are paid, so it's below the minimum wage because the expectation, quote unquote, is that they make up that wage in tips. So you know, in certain parts of the country, the sub-minimum wage can be as little as $3 or $4 an hour. With fingers crossed, a worker can make up that over the course of their shift. Here in Michigan, it's just over $9 an hour, but it's still nowhere near a living wage, a wage in which we can ensure that folks can take care of their families and of their needs.
Yeah, I read something that, you know, the federal minimum wage, the tipped minimum wage, is like $2.13 an hour or
yes.
Something ridiculous like that. Hasn't been raised since the 90s?
Yes, that's correct. And it's really, it affects the most vulnerable among us, right? So there's a misconception that a lot of folks in the tipped wage industry are, you know, teenagers or something, or don't have families to support. And that's just simply not true. And what ends up happening is that so many workers around the country end up having to work multiple jobs in order to make ends meet. It's incredibly difficult to do everything from parent to be a caregiver for a loved one or a family member. And frankly, it's difficult just to take care of your own basic needs when you're working three and four jobs. So it's just so important that folks get the wages that they deserve. And we're really excited here in Michigan because we have an opportunity to give Michigan workers that raise that they've worked so hard for.
So walk me through what's going on here in Michigan. What is it that they've done? What is it that you're doing? And what's the path forward?
Sure. So what's happened is that in 2018, we worked alongside a number of coalition members to get past legislation that would raise the wage for Michigan workers. The legislature back then, with a few dirty tricks on one side of the aisle, made it much more difficult for that raise to move forward. We're fortunate, though, here that we're able to not only ensure that that raise does happen. We have a different governor in Governor Whitmer who's supportive of this. But also we have an opportunity moving forward to have conversations with workers all over the state around how we can maintain the political power that they've created and make sure that they get the results in terms of their wages that they deserve.
It's that political power that I think that's what people are afraid of. You know, because you hear people talking about, well, we can't raise the minimum wage because the price of a hamburger will be $3,000, and you go, now you're being kind of ludicrous because you look at other countries who seem to have figured this out.
Yeah,
who seem to have given their low wage workers some bit of dignity and respect, because we used to believe that, didn't we? I mean, at some point.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Yes. Well, listen, you're in Michigan. We're in the shadow of Detroit right now, where we built the middle class, and so we were able to prove here first that you can have an equitable and safe workspace where folks can make a living wage. And you know, Rick, you don't have to look outside of this country to see examples of this working well, and that it lifts. You know, there's a saying that a rising tide lifts all boats. There are states all over the country in which there isn't a sub-minimum wage.
Like which states?
So California is one of them.
Well, California, the prices of things are just completely outrageous, I'm told.
Well, that's true, but that's not because of workers in the food service industry or tip wage workers. There's a number of other things that that affect that, but that, you know, there are states all over the country, as I said, where you're seeing higher wages for workers than you see at the federal level, and you just don't see the economic impact, the doom and gloom that so many folks have said in the past. And you know, one of the things that I've noticed quite a bit in this work is in talking to small business owners, and in particular restaurant owners, they talk a lot about the inability that they have to hire workers to staff shifts throughout the week.
We've been finding it. Look, we on this trip, we've been eating out an awful lot, mm-hmm. and you go into places, you know, they're understaffed.
Yeah.
They're having a problem finding people because, you know, one, jobs are plentiful. There are places for people to work. But two, I got to tell you, I wouldn't want to work in the service industry, given the fact coming out of the pandemic, we're miserable to each other.
Yeah.
And for $2.13 an hour, there's no way I'm putting up with somebody's nonsense.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, one of the things to remember, too, is so, of course, we're seeing a lot of folks, that have left the industry as a result of the stresses of having to not only do the job, but also, you know, mitigate a community health risk with the pandemic. But, you know, I've also found that restaurant owners and small business owners are not a monolith. So there are plenty out there that are progressive, that pay their workers what they, a wage that they deserve, a living wage. And
here's where I got to stop here. Because mm-hmm. I guess it's one of my pet peeves.
Yeah.
The word deserve doesn't belong there. It's one of my pet peeves. They earn this.
Absolutely.
You earn this.
Absolutely.
The wealth that's being created in these establishments is done because of the people who actually do the work. And this is where I think working people really have to stand up and puff their chest up a little bit and say, I did this. I built this. I made this profitable. And I should be sharing in it. I demand I share in it.
Yeah.
I guess this is just a pet peeve of mine, and it just sends me into a rage.
I appreciate it, and I happily stand corrected, Rick.
I don't mean to correct you, but it's just that I hear that so often. We deserve this. No, you don't deserve it. You earned it.
It
should be your right to it. And I guess it's semantics on a certain level.
No, it's a value statement, and it really reflects what I was saying about, you know, there's so many progressive, for example, restaurant owners that respect that their workers have earned this, that they work very hard, that they not only have earned a living wage, but in many that also have earned the right to health care and to paid time off. So it's really a value statement, Rick. So I agree with you.
Wow. Can you say that again so my wife hears it? Hey, could you say that I'm right again?
Yes, and I'll even write it down.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Roland Leggett. Roland's the Midwest campaign manager for the good folks over at One Fair Wage. OneFairWage.org is their website if you want to check out the work that they do. Highly suggested and doing fantastic stuff, not just here in Michigan, but across the country. And you guys have had some pretty significant wins, I guess. In Maine, you're doing some work right now on the ground to move this forward as well, right?
Yeah, and we're doing work in Maine, the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., rather, and you know, a number of other states. We have a big push planned in Ohio for later this month and into November. So we're working all over the country. And the idea is to bring a living wage to tip wage workers all over the country, and we're going state by state. And it's a movement that's built by the workers in the industry. So we're not, you know, kind of swooping in and getting this work done. It's led by folks on the ground in these states that are focused on this issue.
And the idea of, you know, building that worker power. And this is something I talk about quite often, because I've been very fortunate in my work life that I've always had a union. I've always had a union card in my wallet. I've always had that kind of empowerment that I've had a voice in the workplace. And if I wanted something done, you know, it was going to get done. I think every worker should have that sense of empowerment. And this is moving in that direction, I believe.
Absolutely. And the way we're doing this, as I was saying, because we're utilizing the talents of workers in this industry, is that it's a movement built by the folks that are most affected by what we're talking about here. It's built by the folks that are doing everything from bussing the tables to cooking the food, all, you know, every aspect of these industries. And so it makes it that much more impactful, and there's so much more ownership in so many of the canvassers and volunteers that we have with this, because they're the ones we're fighting for each other.
Yeah, so let me ask you the other side of this, because I know I've got some conservative friends whose heads are exploding at the fact that we want, you know, someone who is bussing tables or washing dishes or serving or cooking or doing any of the things that the people that you represent. Their heads exploding. Well, these aren't jobs that are worth $15 an hour. I don't even make $15 an hour. So what's the response to that these aren't skilled jobs that are worthy of that kind of income?
Well, I would say that, as you said earlier, this isn't about, I don't think it's even about a skilled set. It's about workers working hard and earning a fair living wage. And, you know, I certainly do not think it's up to me to decide what a skilled worker or role is or isn't, but I do know that a worker that is doing all that they can to do their job well certainly has earned a wage that would allow them to live a life to reflect that. And so that's really what this is about. And that's why I said earlier that, you know, that I was happily corrected, because it's a value statement. It's about values. And I'm someone, and I know that the rest of the folks at One Fair Wage are as well, folks that believe that if you've earned something, that's something that you have, that you should get, and that includes a living wage.
And it should be demanded and fought for, absolutely, without question. But again, we're sold this message, Roland, aren't we? That, you know, some work is valued more than others. Some people are valued more than others based on what they do. And I've always been a believer in, I don't care what it is you do, work should be rewarded. Work should be valued. And there's dignity in all work, no matter what it is you do. Because, well, that's how people support themselves. And I think we used to believe that. I think back to my grandparents' generation, it didn't matter if you were a truck driver or a doctor or a lawyer. All work had value.
Yeah, I do think that. But I also think that there are more people that agree with that today than you might think. And I see examples of that all over the state of Michigan and in the states we're working in around the country, that people value work. And when they hear about how difficult it is to get to work in so many of these roles, they understand how important it is that folks get what they've earned. And I'm also, you know, I'm an optimist. I'm a firm believer that we have more in common than we have that separates us. And as a country, as a people, there are so many things we were told were impossible, from the moon landing to a black president. You know, you pick your, you know, there's a number of things to pick through history that we have accomplished that wasn't even, that was supposed to not be possible. And given our proud history of being able to do things we were told impossible, I know that making sure that tip wage workers earn a living wage all over this country is something that is 100% possible.
I can't do any better than that. That's a perfect place to end this. Roland, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great stuff, my friend. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thanks for having me, Rick, and thank you for coming to Michigan.
Thank you so much, Roland Leggett, Midwest campaign manager here with the good folks at One Fair Wage. Make sure you check out their website, onefairwage.org. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. 50,000 people gathered in the small town of Mount Olive in southern Illinois. They had come to commemorate a new memorial to renowned labor leader Mother Jones and to honor mine workers who had lost their lives. 5 special trains and 25 Greyhound buses helped to bring the crowd to the Union Miners Cemetery. The cemetery was founded as a resting place for fallen miners. In 1898, in the town of Verdun, violence erupted. Remembered as the Verdun Massacre, 7 miners were shot dead at the hands of company hired guns. 4 of the murdered miners were from Mount Olive. The miners were originally laid to rest at the town's burial plot, but the owners of the cemetery objected to the ceremonies that the union held there. So, the local miners' union purchased land and moved 3 of their brothers to the new union cemetery. When Mother Jones died at the age of 100 in 1930, she asked to be buried with her boys at the cemetery. The miners raised more than $16,000 for a monument. The 22-foot-tall obelisk is made of 80 tons of pink Minnesota granite. On the obelisk is a medallion bearing the likeness of Mother Jones. She is guarded on either side by a larger-than-life bronze statue of a coal miner with his sledge. In 2015, a crowd of 300 gathered for a rededication of the monument. Illinois AFL-CIO and the United Mine Workers of America spearheaded the campaign to raise $100,000 to restore the site. One of those who attended the rededication was Bill Felica, a local retired miner. He told a reporter, "Mother Jones is like a local hero. She wasn't afraid to stand up to the big shots like judges and politicians. She was just a hellraiser." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Spent a little time here at Baker's Bar in Hamtramck, Michigan, enjoying our time with our friends at One Fair Wage. Spending a little time with tipped workers, hearing the stories that they share and the lives that they lead. Sadly, the amazing part of this is, and I don't know how folks, a lot of these folks, I don't know how they make it. When you hear the fact that the minimum wage, the tipped minimum wage on the federal level is like $2.13 an hour, hasn't been raised since the 1990s, you go, I think there's a problem. Houston, I think we have a problem. And I'm sitting here with the producer, the professor, my working class heroes, tour mate, my friend Brett Pransky. Brett, how we doing?
We're doing good. We're doing good. It's a great place. I'm real happy to be here.
So, you know, in talking about the fact that there is a sub-minimum wage, you know, it's bad enough that 7.25 is the minimum wage. I still have no idea how anyone exists on that. But to drop that down and go, well, you know what, 213 is probably going to be enough. And, oh, by the way, if the employer is going to be good enough, nice enough to raise that up to the 725 to make up the difference, that's how the law is kind of written, knowing, and I think we know that some employers, well, cheat, lie, steal, thieves, not great, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They do it all the time. And when you think about the sub-minimum wage and, you know, just the existence of it in the first place is really criminal when you look at it. And you have to think to yourself, now, how did this originate? At what point did we decide that the minimum wage was too good for some workers, so we need to lower it? And when you consider it, you know, at the time that these wages came into place, a lot of these roles are filled, you know, or at least have been historically by women. Now it's a little more, it's a little more even now. But these were career fields, you know, in the past that were almost exclusively filled by women. And sometimes you think that the wage probably existed not because, you know, anyone was doing any math, but simply they were looking at who was doing the jobs and then trying to decide what they thought those folks deserved.
Now, I go back to some of the responses I've gotten over the years, because we've talked about this on the program, you know, thousands of times over the years, and how ridiculous it is to have this split wage, because I'm against the idea of two-tier wage structures as a whole. But I come back to it, and I struggle with a society that, you know, is going to take care of us, is going to clean up after us, is going to feed us, is, you know, people we called heroes, essential, all that stuff. And then we expect them to get by on poverty, desperation wages. And this is one of the moments, and one of the things we talked about with Roland is, you know, workers understanding their power and coming together and organizing in a way that will increase that power. Now, I don't know that you're ever going to get back to the days where you have waitress and waiter unions. I don't know that that's going to happen. So lobbying as they're doing to increase, you know, the laws and using the legal system to make their situation better, like we see in California with the Fast Recovery Act, where across the industry they're raising standards, maybe that's the way forward.
Yeah, I really think it is, because what's really interesting about what they're doing in California is the results. Some of the counter arguments to raising the sub-minimum wage is people think that prices are going to go up. And what we're finding is when we do eliminate these sub-minimum wages, prices don't increase, or at least they don't increase substantially. All the doom and gloom and kind of those kinds of stories that people use to kind of say that we shouldn't do this, they turn out not to be true when these things are actually implemented.
Now, what's interesting to me is, you know, over the years, I've talked to, you know, wait staff and people who this is their career, and I've asked them about this. Do you favor, you know, closing the sub-minimum wage and going to a wage system? And what's interesting to me is how many people come back, no, we can't do that. We can't possibly do that because X, Y, and Z. You know, they'll get rid of the job, or, you know, they'll cut my, you know, they'll cut the number of people doing this, all kinds of negative stuff. And with some of the people we talked to, you know, some of the organizers, they were explaining that this is the other NRA's handiwork at play, not the gun people, right? The National Restaurant Association, who is equally as powerful, just a little more quiet. Their lobbying efforts are paid for, actually, and I didn't know this, are paid for by the workers, because to work in a restaurant, you have to get this Safe Serve certification that says you know how to work with food, you understand, you know, all of the important things, that the hygiene, the OSHA stuff that you need to know to work around food and to keep people safe. But to pay for this, the money that goes to paying for that certification, the NRA is using, the other NRA is using to lobby to keep the wages low. So it's this kind of scenario where the workers are actually paying to screw themselves over.
Yeah, it's kind of like, paying ATM fees to access your own money. I mean, it's
exactly,
you know, things like, I mean, it's the craziest thing. So we're actually charging the workers and then using their money to work against their interests, and using that money to feed this system of lies that says, oh, your job's going to go away, or oh, people won't tip anymore if the wages are raised. And you know, it's just not true, and it's absolutely criminal that we're stealing wages to fund all this nonsense.
No, it's the fear that they really, you know, because look, these people are struggling to get by as is. And I remember this, I was at a Pizza Hut, and the waitress, I was talking to her, and she said, you know, she was against it because they've already told her that if this happens, that if the $2.13 minimum wage is raised up to what they're supposed to be mandating, to the 7.25 number, that her job would be eliminated. I'm going, really? And you buy that? And she did, because she was fearful that she was going to lose this situation.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, you know, just a quick note to business owners out there, if these wages were to change and you can't pay them, or you don't think you can pay them, the problem isn't the wages, and the problem certainly isn't the workers. The problem's your business model.
Yep. No, you probably shouldn't be in business. And I've heard that, you know, time, oh, I just can't compete. Well, maybe, I don't know, take up cutting grass.
Or do something else. Yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, because we need these people to make living wages. I mean, I understand desperation is a powerful tool, and that we've used desperation for years and years and years to, you know, to keep people chained to jobs that they might otherwise leave, and, you know, and find something else, you know, to do. But I think it's about time, especially, you know, if the pandemic taught us anything, it's that we are propped up by a massive number of employees who we are not paying nearly enough for the work that they do. You know, and that's a battle I'll have with anyone anywhere. We depend, all right, in huge ways on people that we keep in desperate situations simply because we choose to. So for example, if I encounter a worker who's working for a subminimum wage, say a server at a restaurant or a bar, I can control whether the next hour or the next hour and a half of that worker's life is going to work out the way it should.
Yep.
You know, and it shouldn't be mine to control that as a customer.
No, absolutely not. It's something we should make sure that the workforce, they get the wages they deserve and be able to support their family, dignity and respect in the workplace. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around here from Baker's Bar in Hamtramck, Michigan.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So back here at Baker's Lounge in Hamtramck, Michigan. Yes, I'm actually in Michigan. Again, a kid growing up in Cleveland, this is one of those places, you know, it's almost like not quite Pittsburgh, but it's on that list. But you know, everyone we've met here, fantastic. And in fact, I'm sitting here with one of my favorite people in Congress, Representative Andy Levin. Andy, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, Rick, it's great to have you in Michigan. Welcome to Hamtramck, brother.
Yeah, I got to tell you, we drove into Michigan, and I'm kind of like, a little uneasy, but everyone here, fabulous.
Yeah, no, we love our ribbing with our friends from Ohio or Pennsylvania or whatever, but it's, you know, there's a feeling about the Midwest that, you know, of hospitality and down to earthness and welcoming and taking care of each other.
Because I think the reason is that the communities are so similar. We mm-hmm. just came out of Erie. You know, I grew up in Cleveland. It could have been the same thing. They were identical.
Yeah. And I mean, oh my God, the history of this little town, you know, Hamtramck. I mean, it's just amazing. It's within the city of Detroit, really. And it was a real Polish enclave. And now it's diverse beyond belief. It's the first place in America, I think, to have a majority Muslim city council, and it's got a lot of incredibly rich culture of people from around the world. So it's an amazing American place. We're sitting here right here in this car.
The story, I mean, you know, and part of what we're doing on this tour is talking about places like this that at one point were, you know, the high point of middle class living, of, yep, you know, working class prosperity, and then, you know, whatever reason, you know, things got really bad, and now things are, you know, starting to arc their way up, and you know, regardless of who's living here, things are getting better.
Things are getting better, and one of the it's just astounding to watch like what's happening in America. All of my colleagues in Congress are and on the Democratic side are saying, you know, we have to make it in America, you know, reshore, onshore, all bring manufacturing job back. And I'm thinking, dang, a lot of y'all voted for every stupid trade agreement that ever. About Democrats, not Republicans. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Republicans are always been horrible on trade. But, you know, a lot of my dear friends in the Democratic Party voted for NAFTA. They voted for every trade agreement. And now they're like, wait a minute, we have supply chain issues. I'm like, hello.
Yeah, welcome to the club.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here.
All our jobs are in China. Hello. You know.
Where
anyway,
you been?
Right. So
no, this is where, you know, this is part of what we're doing. You know, the reality is we've got to have these conversations. You got to talk to people and explain them. Look, you know, we made some mistakes. And I argue that, you know, you go back to deregulation. You know, deregulation, Democrats did that too.
Right.
And Republicans
airlines,
used it.
Trucking.
Absolutely.
It was a big mistake.
But. And the same thing, I come back to this point that Democrats believed that they were doing the right thing, that they were going to help people, they were going to move things forward. Republicans knew what they were doing. They knew yeah. this was going to crush the working class and consolidate wealth. There's a difference in motive, I believe.
No question.
Or am I wrong?
No, you're right. But also, I mean, Democrats are, if you look at, you know, everybody talks about bipartisanship, and I actually do a lot of bipartisan legislating in Congress, but if you ask a Democrat, well, why are you Democrat? What are you proud of? Or what has the Democratic Party accomplished? They're going to talk about things that we did in the 1930s, in the 1960s, that are definitional of the Democratic Party and of justice in America.
Yep.
And it was all accomplished with huge majorities of Democrats in the House and the Senate under LBJ, back under FDR. And we need to, you know, I'll do bipartisan, basically the, you know, when we got Republicans in there, I'll work with them. But we need to build huge Democratic majorities and transform this country so that the working class can breathe and live the American dream again. And that's what I'm my
But you
got to
go back there
about.
And you got to be talking to working people. The sad
yeah,
reality is most
exactly.
working people don't believe that Democrats are the party of working people anymore. Now, I understand, and I say this all the time, that Republicans hate working people. Just look at their policies.
Yeah.
And that comes out in everything they do. But Democrats haven't really been the champion for a while.
Well, that's the, yeah, and there's this whole thing about style. You know, like, the Democrats are like the coastal elites or the wine swilling, this, that. I mean, whatever. Here's the thing. Who's going to butter your bread? Who's going to give you living wages? Who's going to recognize your freedom to form unions and bargain collectively? Who's going to get health care for everybody? Who's going to control the price of prescription drugs? And the Republicans aren't going to do any of that. So you're right. We have to marry the progressive policy and the working class policy with actually getting out there and talking to working class people, being amongst them. How about getting more of them to run for office and having, you know, more working people in the House, in the Senate, you know, in the state legislatures. I mean, that's another whole angle that's very important.
I would love to have more Democrats and more Republicans and more people in the halls of power who know how to change a tire.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the sad reality, I think that should be a test.
It used to be change your oil. Now almost nobody does. We all changed our oil around here when we were kids.
I mean, absolutely. Still do.
Yeah, but this, you know, now people, I mean, the cars are just so complicated and computerized that people are scared to do their basic maintenance. But in my car, you know, I drove here in a Chevy Bolt. It doesn't have oil. There's no oil to change.
I'm waiting to be rich enough to be able to afford a
the Bolt's pretty
vehicle.
Good. I mean, when the $7,500 you know, credit was there for GM, you know, it was near the average price of a car. So now we've legislated to bring back the incentives to buy electric cars. But
so how come nobody knows that? Why aren't we telling that story?
Well,
because all I keep hearing is I wish I could be rich like those latte drinking Volvo driving liberals that you
exactly,
hang around with. Rick.
Exactly.
So why don't we hear enough of that?
I don't know. You know, one of my favorite bills, for example, that I've been championing in Congress is the Got Truckers Act, the Guaranteed Overtime for Truckers Act. And it's the shortest bill I ever wrote. It basically, do you know, I mean, I don't know if your listeners, viewers know, that long-haul truck drivers don't get overtime. And back in the 30s, when the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed, they figured, well, you know, we don't want the law. It's logical, but also backwards. We don't want truck drivers to drive super long hours, so that's not safe. So therefore, don't give them overtime. Well, except what you're doing just there is you just gave the boss an incentive to work them super long because they're not going to make overtime. And you're guaranteeing people having – so the working conditions are miserable for truckers. Whether they're an employee trucker, a Teamster member, or whether they're an independent operator, you know, they're and the industry's created all these schemes and tricks, you know. Oh, you're all the time that you're waiting for the equipment to be the cartage to be loaded on your truck, you're not paid. That's, you know, you're waiting, you're not driving, you're paid by the mile, you're not doing a mile. I mean, what normal person wouldn't say you're at work? You just drove 900 miles. You're sitting at a steel mill waiting for steel coil to be loaded on your truck. I don't think you're taking care of your kids. I don't think you're going out to dinner with your wife. You were at blanking work right there.
No, you're
not being paid for it.
I know you know. I've been a truck driver for over 30 years.
Yeah.
All this stuff is stuff I talk about. And I think your bill was fantastic. What I think you put
Did
people
you hear we got a Senate companion? That just happened.
Get out.
Yeah, we got a Senate companion bill. I swear, I don't think it'll pass while I'm here, you know, because this is my last term. But I think eventually we'll pass this bill because it's just such common sense to let. So if you let truck drivers make overtime, then you're raising your wages for truckers. You'll have less turnover. It'll be a better job. You'll have more safety because most accidents involving truckers are with rookie drivers, you know, first-year drivers. So if you'll have more veteran drivers, it'll be safer. And the industry will actually benefit despite themselves because they'll have to rationalize it. They, you know, and instead of trying to force, you know, they're like, oh, well, why should I hire three people, you know, to do 120 hours? I'll just have two people. Therefore, I save a whole pension, you know, whatever. I save the employer taxes. I save whatever I give on health care. But that is not a good way to run a business.
No, but the other side of this is, and we talk about supply chain shortages, and, you know, the ports were all jammed up, and
exactly.
There were truck drivers that were waiting there, just sitting.
Yes.
And if you would have had somebody whose responsibility is to make sure that they were utilized properly, we hear about trucker driver shortages all the time. There's not a shortage. There's just a misappropriation and misuse of people's time and energy because just what you said.
If you have to pay for the time.
If you had to pay for them sitting there.
Yeah. Hello. You're going to make it work efficiently. And
exactly.
You know,
and this is where I think this is where legislation like that has to come out, because I know my truck driver buddies, they're all, you know, ratchet jaw Trump supporters.
I know that's why I've had so much fun with this, because this legislation has put me on these trucker shows and everything. And I've had the best time. They have call ins. You know, I talk to these truck drivers and I'm like, I don't care what party you are. You deserve to make a living wage. You deserve to, you know,
even
not
if
have
you
to
don't
work
want
these
long. To. And this is what I do when I was doing organizing with the Teamsters. This is what I used to tell them. I would show them my paycheck. I'd say, here, you don't even have to show me yours. This is what I make for my $50 a month. And I wish I could get the kind of return on investment that I get for my union dues that I get in my paycheck that you're not getting. Because unlike you, I get paid for my waiting time. I get paid for breakdown time. I get paid for dropping hooks. I get paid for all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because I'm part of a union. And this is where, you know, I love your bill, but I still say you should be joining a union.
Oh, 100%. And the Teamsters are the union's a big supporter of this bill. But, you know, we've got a massively organized all truckers and every other works. Guess what happened today? This is a news flash.
Sure.
The latest Starbucks to form a union was the one by my house, right out here by my house. They voted 9-2 or something.
Nice.
So another Starbucks unionizing with Workers United. And,
good,
you know, that company is using every union busting trick in the book to try to, you know, they're giving all these benefits to only the non-union stores. They're
Which is, know, a violation.
Violation. They're dragging everything out. But, you know, ultimately, we have to help workers organize across the map. And that organizing has to drive to force Congress, to the Senate, to join the House and finally passing labor law reform. And that'll unleash a whole much, 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 much bigger wave of organizing like happened in the 30s and 40s.
No, and hopefully we get a couple more senators like we see. Like last night we were in Erie and we saw, you know, Senator Casey and Senator Sherrod Brown, you know,
champions of workers,
pitching for John Fetterman. They're also out there, you know, pitching for Tim Ryan. It'd be great to see two more Democrats in the Senate.
We get Tim and Fetterman. We're going to, you know, keep the Senate and maybe grow things. Yeah.
We could maybe get some things done and maybe return reward back to work. Because, you know, the sad reality is you brought up Starbucks. And I get it thrown back at me all the time. Well, Democrats are just as bad as Republicans on labor because Howard Schultz was probably going to be Secretary of Labor had Hillary Clinton won.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, let that steam around in your head for a second.
I'm letting it pass right by, Rick. I don't even want to think about that. Look, we got Marty Walsh right now.
I love
he's
Marty.
The laborer.
He's been on the program a bunch.
He's a great guy. And Joe Biden's the most pro-worker president. Look, when I called the White House and I talked to one of his aides and I said, you know, I think this campaign at Amazon in Bessemer, Alabama is really something. I mean, you've got basically a very young, overwhelmingly African-American workforce in the Deep South here, which is trying to organize with Amazon. You know, maybe the president should say something. The idea that within a month or so, he didn't just say something, he made a video.
Yep.
You know, and then he's done that over and over again. And I think that has made a
huge
difference.
Where was he? You know, where was he in 2011? You know, where was Obama with the comfortable shoes when what was happening in Wisconsin?
Yeah.
You know, while I was sleeping on the granite floor there in Wisconsin while Scott Walker was pulling his nonsense.
Right.
We didn't hear anything. And this is, again,
when we got right to freeload, as I call it, here in Michigan.
Absolutely.
You know we were marching around in Lansing. There was nobody coming in from D.C. to help us.
And this is why I think in this moment, to hear people like Sherrod Brown and Bob Casey, you know, saying the things that they were saying last night, Mary, the kind of things that you say, that has to be the message. We have to get away from all the other crazy stuff. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Representative Andy Levin here from Michigan. But, you know, this has got to be the message going forward, regardless of all the other stuff. This economic, between the curbs, kitchen table stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, how much can I make? Can I take care of my family? Can I get health care? You know, from my point of view, everybody should have, we should have, you know, Medicare for all. Everybody should have health care.
Perfect story. You know, my son, just before we started this tour, had his appendix burst.
Oh, my God. How is he?
He's doing really well now. Just got the tube taken out of his nose. He's so happy.
How old is he?
He's 16.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
it was traumatic. It was
terrible. But you know, as I said on the program, the one thing that I did not worry about, didn't even think about until after everything was over, was how am I going to pay for it? I've got Teamster negotiated healthcare. I've got probably better healthcare than you've got.
Yeah, I'm sure you
do. I got my hip replaced. It cost me $120 out of pocket.
Let me tell you what.
I got good healthcare. The reason I bring this up, Congressman, is that I want everyone to have the kind of security that I have, knowing that I just want my son to be well. I want him to get the best care he can get and not have to worry about, am I going to go bankrupt, knowing that medical debt is the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country.
Number one
cause. That people lose their homes. They end up homeless because of medical debt. I don't want anyone to have that problem.
And I'm all for the Affordable Care Act, but despite all the tinkering, we still have millions and millions of people with no health insurance at all. And as you say, the amount of debt, medical debt, most of that's all of it is people with insurance. It's because they have, you know, plans that don't pay for much, or they, you know, run out of coverage or whatever. I mean, I think people have a hard time even imagining what universal health care. The idea is that we would all collectively pay for health care, and then you wouldn't be picking doctors or pharmacies or long-term care facilities or any of that based on money. Money wouldn't have anything to do with it. It's the relationship between a doctor and a patient, a nurse and a patient, you know, a facility and a patient, a therapist and a patient. And it would all be just about taking care of people. We'd be a healthier society for sure, and there'd be a lot less of anxiety among working people.
Yeah, no, I say it all the time. I'm fortunate, and I'm grateful for my union and what they've negotiated for me and my family in these moments, because I don't know how I would react if my first thought was, I can't afford this.
Yeah.
Other than going, I just want the best for my kid.
That's the only thing you should have to think about. All Americans should have to
think about. That's it. And to your point, we should have one giant insurance pool. I don't get this. Basic insurance, bigger the pool, lesser the risk.
Basic theory of it, right. And I mean, every other country manages to do it. Why can't we? It's just crazy.
It's crazy. So I want to bring it back to why you came down to Baker's Bar here in Hamtramck. And thank you for coming and visiting us here at the One Fair Wage event. Michigan's done some pretty interesting, some pretty good things on the One Fair Wage front, getting rid of the sub-minimum wage, haven't they?
Well,
I mean, that's coming.
It's not there yet. But, I mean, the situation is, look, the idea that we have these sub-minimum wages still, that people, that tipped workers make, you know, $3, whatever, $4 an hour, and then they're supposed to make it up in tips. And then if they don't get enough tips, supposedly their employer fills the gap. Well, that's just a structure for wage theft. Right, because it's setting it up so that what if the employer shorts you? You know, you're gonna, first of all, will you even know? Secondly, what are you gonna do? Who are you gonna go to? And anyway, the whole idea that people, 70% of tipped workers are women. What do you think they have to feel like when they, you know, to get their tips? If some jerk is at the table treating them badly, you know, it's just it's wrong, 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 and it's a vestige of Jim Crow anyway. Because it, you know, it come. That's where the whole idea of tipped workers comes from. And tipped workers are not only 70% women; they're way disproportionately of color. So we have fought super hard here to get rid of sub-minimum wages for tipped workers and to raise our minimum wage for all Michiganders up to $15 an hour or more. And we had a big petition drive. We're on the way. We're not quite there yet. It's not going to be on the ballot this year, but we're hoping to get it on the ballot soon. The main one thing that we really have to do is flip the state legislature. We're one of those states. There's a bunch of them that even though, like, we've had two U.S. senators who are Democrats forever.
Yep.
We've got a Democratic governor. All our statewide elected officials are Democrats. How come our state legislature is majority Republican in both the state Senate and the House, and, you know, and to some extent approaching supermajorities? It's gerrymandering the way it was. Well, we got rid of partisan gerrymandering. This year we have a chance to have the state Senate and the state House become democratically controlled by the Democratic Party. And why that's especially important for this one fair wage thing, because we have this really weird provision in Michigan where if you work to get a ballot initiative on the ballot, a proposal, like we have this year, we're enshrining reproductive rights in our Constitution. We have three ballot proposals that made it this year. One is to make voting easier, then the reproductive rights one, and the third one is about changing term limits and so forth in the legislature and making government be more transparent. But here's the thing. Our state legislature can take a ballot proposal and pass it, and then change it. So we've had minimum wage increases in the past that the Republicans didn't want because it was too much. They adopted it to prevent the voters from passing it in November, and then they cut it in the legislature. It's the most undemocratic thing of all time. So we,
isn't that the point?
I mean, is their point, yeah. So we got to take back the legislature right now so we prevent that from happening. And then that, you know, then when next time around we can pass that initiative. And maybe the legislature itself could pass some good legislation to get rid of tip, you know, minimum, sub-minimum wages.
And maybe we can actually get some things done for working people.
Absolutely.
So it's the last line I want to get into here, with you, because I think we're in a moment coming into the election here. We're at a moment, we're kind of at a crossroads. I think the administration's doing some good things. I think you guys in Congress have done some good stuff. Talking about, you know, investing in our infrastructure, building roads and bridges and all that stuff, and broadband access and urban and rural communities.
Absolutely.
All great stuff. Reshoring manufacturing, investing in the future technologies, all incredible stuff. Talking about strengthening unions and doing that. Will that message resonate come November?
I certainly hope so. I got to add one little specific thing is that, you know, we passed my legislation to allow our own staff in the House to form unions. And we passed it in May. Then in July, the workers in eight offices, including my own, filed for elections. My office was the very first to vote to unionize. They voted unanimously, 9-0, the people in the bargaining unit. It includes my district and my D.C. office. And We're now negotiating the first contract in the history of the 233-year history of the Congress. So even, you know, I'm trying to encourage all my wonderful colleagues to walk the walk, not just talk the talk. So I think all this is breaking through. I mean, I think time, you know, the party of the president who just won an election 2 years before is not supposed to do well in congressional elections. But I think several things are conspiring. Number one, those accomplishments you talked about. Democrats are delivering for working people right now. Number two, around here, the Republicans are putting up nutcase MAGA yahoos who don't even believe in democracy. You know, and that, you know, independent voters and moderate Republicans are not going to go for that. Democrats are certainly not going to go for that. But number three, I think people are sick of all this culture wars that they just want us to get their paycheck big enough so they could survive. They want to have some breathing room. Yep. They want to be able to get childcare. They want to be, and you know, we're the party, we didn't get all of it done that we wanted to, Rick. We didn't get childcare, but we're the ones who tried. You know, we didn't get free community college, my bill passed, but the president wanted to. He wanted to get it done. So people's got to realize if they send some more Democrats to Washington and place capitals like Lansing, we can really deliver for the American people and create a new era of prosperity for working people in this
good
country.
Good stuff. Representative Levin, I appreciate you taking
thanks,
time for
Rick.
Us.
Thanks for being here.
Good stuff. Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it. Going to take a quick break. Right back here from Baker's Bar and Lounge here in Amtramck. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, looking forward to going into the state of Michigan, into Detroit, and, you know, some of our friends there, and I've got lots of friends in Detroit, and a lot of my Teamster buddies, looking forward to seeing them, but also looking forward to the event that we're putting together, and I think this is going to be fun and entertaining and, well, helpful. With our good friends with One Fair Wage, as we talk about, you know, making work pay, reward for work, dignity of work, respect for work, you know, all those frames that we like to talk about. And here to share some thoughts on, well, that concept and maybe the event that we're going to put together there in Detroit on October 7th. I've asked Saruya Raman to come talk with us. She's the president of One Fair Wage, their website, onefairwage.com. Saru, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, this idea of, you know, reward for work, this idea that if you work hard, you play by the rules, that you should actually get ahead, kind of the point of this whole tour that we're throwing together, no matter which hat you wore, the red hat, the blue hat, it's all about making sure that the wages, hours, conditions that we work for, fair.
That's right. And what's so exciting about this moment that you're doing this tour is that for the first time really in our industry, restaurant industry, since emancipation, really, workers are rising up across the country and refusing to work for the poverty wages that they've agreed to work for generations. We've talked before on your show about this history that at emancipation, the restaurant industry basically wanted the ability to hire newly freed slaves, not pay them, let them live on tips. That is the origin of the ridiculously low subminimum wage for tipped workers, which is $2 at the federal level, $3 in Michigan, $4 in Ohio, $6 in Illinois. It's an absurd and ridiculous subminimum wage. Doesn't exist everywhere, only in 43 states. Seven states got rid of it. But even in these 43 states with a subminimum wage, what's so exciting is that literally millions of workers are walking out the door, refusing to work for these subminimum wages, saying, I won't come back unless you pay me a full wage. And we're seeing wages go up for the first time ever. We're seeing restaurants that used to pay $3 and $4 now paying $25 an hour plus tips. It's a really incredible historic moment.
And interestingly enough, they're still doing just fine.
Thank you very much. That's right. We've been at this trying to pass policy for decades to end the subminimum wage for tipped workers and raise the overall minimum wage. And there's been this, you know, very big obstacle in our way. The National Restaurant Association, we call it the other NRA, led by the chains, the Applebee's, the IHOPs. They've been fighting us as a like a very powerful bully for decades, but they've been much more mute in the last 9 months than we've ever seen them, because Applebee's and IHOP need staff too. They need staff too. And they're telling workers, come work for us, we'll pay you more. So they can't fight us in the public arena the way they used to. And we're finally winning. And we just had a big victory in Michigan, and we're about to have a lot more.
No, and let's talk about Michigan, because Michigan, you know, when I grew up as a kid in the 70s, Michigan was an economic powerhouse, as the Midwest was. You know, growing up in Cleveland, it was all about steel and auto. Michigan was all about auto. Detroit was, you know, the Motor City. And now we've moved from a productive economy that built automobiles and factories that built products to a service-based economy. And we pine for those jobs. And part of the thing, what we're finding on this tour is people are going, look, we want those factory jobs back. But what they really want is they want those union wages back.
That's right.
Because
That's
they right. forget that those factory jobs were crummy jobs before That's they right. were union jobs.
They were, in fact, the original sweatshops, right? And now we like to say the restaurant is the new sweatshop. You know, when you're paid $3 an hour, I don't know what else you call it, you know, except a sweatshop. You're overworked and underpaid. And you're right. That was the situation for garment workers and union workers 100 years ago. And they organized and they unionized and they got themselves a higher wage. And now here we are as restaurant workers, I think finally, for the first time ever, demanding the same. So I am hopeful. As bad as it's been with the $3 and $4 wages, I am very hopeful that change is coming. Not just individual restaurants and individual businesses raising wages, but policy is about to change. You know, Michigan, something really incredible just happened in Michigan. So back in 2018, we collected 400,000 signatures to put this issue on the ballot, to raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour and end the subminimum wage for tipped workers, still $3.67 in Michigan. Well, at that time, the Republicans who control the legislature said, we don't want this to drive working people to the polls. So they announced to the press, we're taking this off the ballot. We're going to make it the law. Republicans quadrupled the wages of waitresses in Michigan. But we promised to gut this after the election because we're only doing it to keep people from going to vote themselves a raise. So they went ahead, they raised the wage, and then they turned it back down to $3. And just in the most cruel irony, a year later, those $3 workers who went up to 12 and back down to 3, they were told by the state of Michigan, same state of Michigan, that their wages were too low to qualify for unemployment insurance when they lost their jobs in the pandemic. So, you know, the fact that they are now saying enough is enough, tips have gone way down, harassment is up, I'm just not going to put up with it anymore. All of that happened over the last year. And in July, Michigan Court of Claims ruled that what the Republicans did back in 2018 was unconstitutional. And therefore, the original law that Republicans passed to suppress the vote is now the law of the of Michigan. Michigan has just become the 8th state to end the subminimum wage for tipped workers, and the wage has gone up to 12. We've already collected enough signatures for it to go to 15 and 24. So it just keeps getting better, and Michigan is leading the way. There are a lot of other states about to follow. D.C. and Portland, Maine are on the ballot this November. In Illinois, we've got legislation moving. In California, wages are going up, and we're fighting to end the subminimum wage for incarcerated workers in California. Things are happening all over the country, and it's really, I'm so proud that Michigan is leading on this issue and kicking it off.
Why haven't I heard the Republicans, you know, leading with this, saying that they're the ones who are raising? Why haven't I heard this? I mean, this sounds like something that should be, you know, their pivot to getting working people on their side. Because look, oh I God. Say all the time, Republicans hate working people, but oh you're telling God. Me they raised the wage.
They raised the wage. I mean, it's really not just Republicans. Like, wages have been going up under a Democratic administration. And we've been trying to get Democrats to stand with these issues as well. It's been really, really tough. And I think, listen, this is the thing. We find when we're out there collecting signatures in Michigan, in Ohio, wherever we are, people of all political persuasions agree with us. If we go up to somebody and say, will you sign a petition for 15? They say, whoa, I already signed it. Or where can I sign? There's been almost nobody who opposes this among working people in Michigan and Ohio and other states around the country. It's our elected officials of both parties who somehow think of raising wages as a supposedly controversial issue, and it's like the least controversial, most popular issue that exists. And it's because they all are stuck in this echo chamber with the restaurant association, somehow believing that we can't raise wages because it will hurt our friends in the restaurant association. Now we've got thousands of restaurant owners who are coming out with us saying, listen, we're raising wages. We need it to be a level playing field. We need everybody to go up, because we can't get these workers to come back unless we do.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Saru Yaraman. She's the president of One Fair Wage. OneFairWage.com, their website, if you want to check out the work that they do, and I highly suggest that you do. Now, it's interesting that you point out that both parties kind of not on board with this. This is where I come back to the premise of this tour, where if we're going to unite this country, this is where we do it. I mean, you know, everyone's bought the red hat or the blue hat, and we've picked our teams and we've got our shirts and some have flags and all this stuff. But wages, hours, conditions, that ideal that if we work hard, play by the rules, get ahead. These are the things that I think can, should, and must bring us back together.
Totally. I couldn't agree with you more. I've really been out there trying. I mean, let me just share one example of Michigan. I have my own biases. I live in California. I'm a brown woman. And I went out to do petition gathering in Western Michigan, which is more red. And I brought with me three women of color, all Muslim, in hijab. And we walked up to people in malls and on the street asking them to sign a petition for 15. And we were all pretty scared. You know, it's a pretty white part of Michigan, pretty conservative, older people. And people said, again, where can I sign? Of course I agree with this. A cost of a gallon of gas in Michigan is $5, and you're telling me the wage is $3.67. We had older people tell me, wait a second, that's what I earned 40 years ago. What are you talking about? You know, there was such universal agreement. And I happened to be there, Rick, the week of the shooting in the school in Uvalde, Texas. And it was so painful because once again, you hear this ridiculously, you know, partisan conversation about, you know, what it's so controversial. What can we do? But being there, talking to people, knowing that we are not polarized from each other. We are actually polarized in some cases from our elected officials who don't understand how popular and united we are around the need to just be able to survive and feed your family.
And this is why I keep saying that, you know, whichever party, and I'm hoping the Democrats take this on and make working class issues the center of their platform and really hammer on this. And look, I think Joe Biden has done a fairly good job. I think he's done a good job of moving towards, you know, reinvesting in infrastructure, spending some money on reshoring manufacturing, and talking about workers joining and forming unions to share in the wealth that their labor creates. I think this is moving us back in a positive direction, but we need the policy. We need the legislation and the signature on the dotted line to move this stuff forward.
Absolutely. We need elected officials to understand how popular this is, come out, and also understand this isn't just popular, it drives people to vote who never vote. You know, people feel really disengaged with both parties and candidates, but the opportunity to go vote yourself a raise is the most incredible opportunity of all. So I do want to say, since we're coming up on an election, that part of what we're doing in Michigan and this event that you're coming to in Detroit is all about workers actually telling each other, listen, we just want a raise in the courts. The courts just declared we're going to get a raise to $12 an hour, but we've actually got to go vote for people who are going to enforce it.
Yep.
And I will say, in Michigan, Republicans are not going to enforce this law. If they get into the governorship, if they get the attorney general, they are not going to enforce this law. They never intended for this law to pass. And so there's a very clear choice if we want to see this raise this November in Michigan, what we need to do as working people. But it's not just voting. It's then holding our people accountable, our own people accountable, to actually enforce that race.
Now, I do want to thank you for making me feel really, really old by pointing out that it was more than 35 years ago that I was making $3.35 an hour, which was the minimum wage when I was in high school back 35, 38 years ago. Thanks for that. But here's the thing, and this is the important part. I don't think most people understand that this is the law. And I know where I live in Pennsylvania, the minimum wage is like for tipped workers in this state is less than $3 an hour.
$2.83. It's ridiculous. It's outrageous in 2022. I mean, that is literally half the cost of a gallon of gas. Who is going to go to work when your wage is half the cost? You're not going to pay double to get to work than you get when you get there. You're not going to do it. So give me a break.
There you go. So last line of question I've got for you, because as you said, there are campaigns going on in Ohio, in Maine, and in other places. What's the pitch for folks in those areas? What can people do to help? Because I know working people want to help other working people, because the idea that when we all do better, we all do better. So how do we help?
Please, everybody, thank you so much for asking. Everybody go to onefairwage.org, onefairwage.org. You can sign up to get involved. You can send an email to info@onefairwage.org. You can join us to collect signatures or to talk to voters this November in Michigan. We're going to be collecting signatures in Ohio on Election Day for the $15 minimum wage. In Illinois, tell your legislators to end the subminimum wage for tipped workers. In California, tell your legislators end the subminimum wage for incarcerated workers. And tell everybody who lives in D.C. and Portland, Maine, to vote yes on one fair wage in their cities.
There's an awful lot to get to, so I'm sure go to onefairwage.org, and all of that information will be there. And if you want to sign up, I'm sure there are newsletters and ways to participate and help. Onefairwage.org, right?
That's right. Thank you so much, Rick.
Good stuff. I look forward to seeing you in Detroit on the 7th and Cleveland on the 31st of October. All good stuff. Thanks so much, Saru.
Thank you, Rick.
Appreciate the time, Saru Yaraman, president of One Fair Wage. Again, onefairwage.org, their website. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you against the idea of raising the tipped minimum wage? Because, you know, that $2.83 an hour here in Pennsylvania, and it doesn't go that far. It's criminal in my view, but I'd love to hear yours. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Follow us at thericksmithshow.com. And also, don't forget, grab the podcast. Never miss a moment from our tour. Back after this. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. We will be returning on January 3rd. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1874. That was the day that Mary Heaton Vorse was born in New York City. Mary grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, in a family with significant financial means. She traveled across Europe with her parents, where she received her education and learned to speak multiple languages fluently. She then worked as a book reviewer for the Criterion magazine. In 1912, Mary and the man who would be her husband witnessed what would be known as the Bread and Roses textile strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The experience was a great turning point in her life. She later wrote, "Both Joe O'Brien and I had come a long road to get to Lawrence. Together, we experienced the realization of the human cost of our industrial life. Something transforming happened to both of us. We knew now where we belonged. On the side of the workers and not with the comfortable people among whom we were born. Some synthesis had taken place between my life and that of the workers. Some peculiar change that would never again permit me to look with indifference on the fact that riches for the few were made by misery of the many. It was in Lawrence that we realized what we must do, that we could make one contribution, that of writing the workers' story as long as we lived." For more than 50 years after Lawrence, Mary traveled the United States reporting and participating in strikes and the labor movement. She wrote about the 1919 steel strike and the lumber workers' strike in the Pacific Northwest. She wrote about the struggles of auto workers and textile workers and child labor. In 1962, the United Auto Workers honored Mary with their Social Justice Award. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Baker's Bar here in Hamtramck, Michigan, as we wrap up our day here of talking to low-wage workers, to our friends at One Fair Wage. And remember, check out their website, onefairwage.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. You know, I always like having Saru Yaraman on the program talking about, she's kind of the conscience of the workforce. She's the one who really articulates the struggles of workers at the bottom of the economic scale, the people who take care of us, clean up after us, feed us, do all of the things that maybe we don't notice enough of or take for granted. And I'm sitting here with the executive producer, the professor, my roadmate, Brett Pransky. Brett, thanks for being here.
Hey, happy to be here.
So what'd you think of Saru? I mean, I see her as the conscience of the economy, someone who's pointing out, you know, just how ridiculous it is that we pay these kind of poverty wages to people and then expect them to be, you know, courteous and happy and joyful and cheery. It seems kind of ludicrous to me.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, as I listen to her, what she has to say, how she articulates the argument, the only thing I can really, that really comes to mind is I wouldn't want to be the guy being paid by the restaurant industry to sit on the other side of that debate. Because it's a loser. I mean, she's just so good at articulating the message that you know, if it's loud enough and if enough people hear it, I believe things will change.
Now I go back to this and I've heard this argument before and we talked about it a little bit today. The argument is we'd love to raise the minimum wage. We'd love to treat these workers with dignity and respect. We'd love them to earn a living wage, but you know what? We just can't afford it. You know, your prices would go up and nobody would go out to eat anymore. And you know, the industry would just die. And I think we're in a moment where the industry is kind of dying because, well, you're not paying people a living wage. And we're seeing workers, when they have other options, are choosing better paying options. So, you know, to me, getting rid of the sub-minimum wage, starting to talk about what is a reasonable wage for people who do this kind of work, this is how we save that industry, because we all like to eat out. We all like people to clean our hotel rooms and do the work that we don't want to do. But I think most of us want to make sure that they can lead a good life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that if the wages came up, there would be any real issue in terms of, you know, people going to these places and or being willing to pay these wages. I mean, it's just not a real thing. It's something that the industry, you know, puts out there and puts a lot of money behind in order to kind of scare people into maintaining the status quo.
Yeah, what I love is I love that argument. Well, if you're going to pay them, you know, $7 an hour, why not just pay them $50 an hour or pay them $100? I mean, you've heard these ridiculous arguments. Oh, just pay them this. And I'm going, that's not what's being said here. Shut up and listen. And because nobody's advocating to make a cheeseburger $40. Nobody's, because this is the weird thing. And this is the part that I'm struggling with those arguments. Other countries seem to have figured this out. In other countries, minimum, you know, fast food workers make like 16, 20 bucks an hour with benefits, with vacation, with days off, with sick time, with things that, well, our fast food workers only could at this moment dream about.
Right. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, a lot of these other countries have a greater sense of community than we do. There's a better sense of us. I mean, you know, we've been talking a lot on this trip about the jobs that went away, like the jobs that were shipped overseas, the people who lost industrial jobs and things like that. Well, you know, and this is kind of an incomplete metaphor, but it does kind of demonstrate the point. If you and I and our neighbors and everyone down the street was willing to pay an extra quarter for tube socks, a lot of those jobs wouldn't have gone away. So, you know, being willing to, you know, to handle a small price increase in order to make sure that your neighbor still has a job and your neighborhood still has, you know, still has good schools and things like, all of this feeds into the system. So the idea that there is a we out there, we should care about that we, including these people that we have just been dismissing for a very long time. I mean, yep. It's something we really just need to get away from it.
That's an excellent point. Now, tomorrow on the program, we're going to be in Flint, Michigan, going to the farmers market in Flint, Michigan, to sit down with Attorney General Dana Nessel also going to talk to some folks there and get a sense of what Flint is. Now, you know, real quick, you know, my thought is, you know, what I'm expecting we're going to see in Flint is what the media has framed for us. It's, you know, it's a city on decline. It's basically a hellhole, is what I've been told. It's what's been pitched to me. And I'm kind of interested to find out what I'm going to see, because that frame hasn't played out in the places we've been thus far.
Yeah, I mean, national media, whenever the city name of Flint comes up, all we hear about is, oh, the Flint water crisis and all the terrible things. And I'm sure we're going to run into things that are not ideal. We're going to see that the town has issues, the city has issues, because every city does. But I have a feeling that what we're going to find there is, you know, is a vibrant community. And I'll bet you anything, what we're going to find is it's a community that is doing better now than it was even 2 or 3 years ago. That people are going to talk about, you know, not only the things that have happened that have been bad in the past, but the things that are happening now that are trending in the right direction. Now, that's a guess, but I think that's what we're going to run into.
No, and look, we're here in Hamtramck, you know, this beautiful little place, and coming back is the theme that I keep getting from people. You know, we're on the upswing. Things are getting better. There's investments being made. In fact, the one person said, you know, when he grew up, the rents were like $200. They're now like $1,200. If that's a barometer of an area getting better, you know, there are people on the streets. There's activity in the streets in a positive way, and I think that's so far this is what we've found, that while all the messaging is all negative, the economy's bad, it's terrible, you know, the country's on fire, I'm not finding that with the people we're talking to.
No, neither am I. I mean, we're seeing an arc. We're seeing an arc through history. There was a time, you know, when you know, industry and manufacturing, all these things were here and they were good, and then, you know, there was a time when a lot of that stuff went away and things got pretty bad for a while. And then, you know, recently the story of now is kind of that we're moving into a better place, but it's a matter of, you know, we're one election, you know, or at least, you know, one or maybe two elections away from stopping all that progress and going in exactly the opposite direction. So I think it's, you know, it's really pivotal that everyone gets out and votes.
I can't reiterate that enough. But the reality is we've had a great time thus far on the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. And I want to thank our friends at the American Family Voices for helping sponsor this. Also our friends at Courier Newsroom for sponsoring and helping us do this. I've had nothing but an amazing time thus far meeting people and shaking hands and you know, hearing stories. I want to hear your thoughts. Make sure you email us, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell us what you think, what you want us to focus on, some of the stories that you think are important. And maybe we'll be coming to a town near you. Also, remember, if you're in Chicago on October 11th, the Greg Palast Vigilantes movie event at the Rainbow Push headquarters, Minneapolis on the 12th of October. We're going to be there for also the movie event. You can find more information by going to the station's website or email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Again, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
This is the Best of the Rick Smith Show. We're taking a break during the holiday season, wishing you and yours the very best holiday ever.
You've been listening to the Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.